Welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the fabulous Fireside Room, today's speaker is Michael Pallette, and he will be speaking on politics and holiness. So let's listen in on Michael Pallette.
My name is Michael Pallette, and I teach theology at the Lutheran Seminary in Saskatoon, and one of my areas of interest are theologies of liberation. And usually what I do is every other year lead a group of students and other interested folks down to on a seminar into Central America. And for the last 2 weeks in June of this year, we spent a week in Guatemala and a week in Nicaragua. Again, looking at the role of the church, particularly in dealing with issues of conflict resolution between indigenous peoples and the government of either Nicaragua or Guatemala, and also the role that the church plays in the returning refugees that are now coming back to Guatemala after spending anywhere of up to 12 years in exile in Mexico, the United States, elsewhere because of the military dictatorship that has been going on in Guatemala. So those were the two areas specifically that we looked at and learned something about. And in the previous three sessions, I've tried to talk about that a little bit in some of the specific issues that are going on there, the way in which the governments structure themselves, the understandings they have of indigenous peoples, the relationship between indigenous peoples and their culture and the more dominant culture in terms of both the Spanish culture that is down in those countries and as well as the culture of kind of old-style Christendom that still seems to linger there. And so those have been the topics so far. Tonight, what I'd like to do, and the title was Politics and Holiness, was to kind of take a step back from some of the specific situations and look a little more at that interrelationship between how one can understand the Christian faith and Christian practice and maybe even spirituality, and that's kind of all under that label of holiness, as something that is not contrary to or going against the kinds of issues and politics and structuring of a society that is involved in those areas. And also to push that in terms of saying what we as Christians in North America can learn in terms of this trying to hold together our sense of politics and holiness. First of all, I'd like to begin with a quotation from Archbishop Oscar Romero. This is from his third pastoral letter, which was written in October 1979, after three priests who were working with the poor in El Salvador had been assassinated, probably by the Salvadoran army. And this is again about 6 months before Archbishop Romero himself was assassinated. And in his pastoral letter, he writes these two sentences. He says, "I rejoice that our church is persecuted because it has opted for the poor and because it has tried to become incarnate with the poor. Assassinated priests are the witness of the church incarnate in the problems of the people." I think the key thing, and one of the things that I want to look at tonight, is that notion of incarnation and how one understands the life of the Christian as a life which is to be incarnated, right? Made flesh, made real and living among the life of the poor, or among those areas, situations, realities where oppression, injustice, poverty, suffering are happening. Now, in order to say that, in order to hold to that kind of understanding of incarnation, I think we have a basic presupposition at work, or kind of a basic thesis. And this is kind of my thesis sentence for the evening. So if you want to, I don't know if you want to write anything, but if you want to write something, I have the thesis sentence. Everything else is just expansion. So if you fall asleep after this sentence, it's okay, right? So just stay awake this long. And that is, right, what I think the people of Latin America are telling us is that the prophetic dimension of Christianity necessarily maintains a distinction between church and state, but never the atheistic view that the gospel has nothing to say about politics. Okay, so because we're Christians, and because we at times exercise that prophetic role, right, and who we are as Christians, it means that we do keep a distinction between church and state, right, particularly institutionally, right? We don't want to necessarily claim that church and state should be the same institution. Right, that the President of the United States should also be the head bishop of the ELCA. Probably not a good idea. Nor should Bishop Chilstrom or Bishop Sardison in Canada be President of the United States or Prime Minister of Canada. There's that distinction because the church and the state have two different functions or roles within society. But we shouldn't confuse that distinction with the understanding that what? That the gospel has everything to say about our politics. Right? And I mean, you know, sometimes or often, and particularly among Lutherans, right, we like to have this little phrase like, oh, well, you know, Pastor, there shouldn't be any politics from the pulpit. Wrong. Right. And that's what they're wrong. Why is that? Because obviously the gospel does have something to say about our political life, right? It's to say, and I want to find another marker here, right? To say, if we say that the gospel has nothing to say about politics, that the gospel doesn't ask us to take some kind of political stances to say something, basically that means we are saying politics is within the realm of atheism. Okay? No God. God has nothing to do with politics. And that's not correct. I mean, God is not necessarily always going to vote Democratic or NDP, although some may think God comes close to being or used to be an NDP, or I don't know about now anymore. Right? We're not talking again about political parties, but we certainly have to say God is very concerned about what's going on politically and has something to say about that. Right. I mean, both Hebrew scriptures and New Testaments are filled with political statements and what God is about. The most basic political statement of all, which we get again from Latin America, one of their favorite phrases, is just simply this understanding. That God is a God of life. That's a very political statement, right? Whether we talk about creation and to say what is the will of God is as manifest in creation. The creation is good. That life is good. That all human beings are created in the image of God. And that is good, and therefore they are valuable to God and important to God, and are not to be devalued, dehumanized, oppressed, right, by other human beings or by anyone or anything else, right? That would be contrary to God's will in terms of who God is as creator. But that's also the very basic and bottom line of redemption as well. God comes into the world in Christ to redeem the world so that what? We might have life. And have life abundantly, John says in his gospel. And that abundant life is not just otherworldly life. It's not that Christ came so that we can have life once we die. That life, that eternal life that Jesus talks about in John's gospel, happens already now. Or again, Martin Luther would want to put that in this way. The Lutheran way of understanding this is two notions of freedom. And if you've been at Christine Carlson's Bible studies, you know all about this, right? She's filled you in on this about community in Romans and what freedom means and all of that. There's the two senses of freedom. We are free from, right? And for Luther, that would mean we're free from things like sin, death, the devil, the law. But we're also free for what? Love, justice, care of the earth, and so on and so forth. And again, I think sometimes that as Christians in North America, and particularly as Lutherans, I'll be tough on the Lutherans, right, because I am one and I work with a lot of them, so I know their faults better than anyone else's faults. But we usually do a pretty good job of preaching free from, right? How we have been justified by faith, how Christ has freed us from sin, death, and the devil. And then very often we say that, and you know, that takes us about 17 minutes to say in a sermon, and we know that in most people's attention span is 20, and so at that point we take a little breath and then say, oh yes, and God also frees us for loving one another. Amen. Right? And we pay attention to the free for in 30 seconds, and then kind of leave it up to everybody else now to figure out what you have to do. Or the illustration of free from and free for. In the end of Ephesians, the letter to Ephesians, chapter 6, you won't need Bibles. I'll just read it to you as for the sake of illustration here. But Paul works with a wonderful metaphor, not necessarily that it has to be a military metaphor, but the metaphor he's working with here is putting on the whole armor of God. And really the metaphor isn't just simply, you know, being a soldier getting ready for war, but it's that notion of, right, people have to get dressed. And if you're going to get dressed, right, if you're going to go out there and do something and get dressed, you have to be fully dressed. And so Paul is saying, take the whole armor of God. And so what you have to do is fasten the belt of truth around your waist, the breastplate of righteousness, as shoes for your feet. Put on whatever will make you ready to proclaim the gospel of peace. With all of these, take the shield of faith with which you will be able to quench all the flaming arrows of the evil one. Take the helmet of salvation, the sword of the Spirit. Okay. Now again, it seems that for many of us in North America, what we really emphasize is the helmet of salvation. Right? So in other words, very often, North American theology always tells us, put on your hat. But how prepared are you for anything if all you do is put on your hat? right? What would we think of Gus and what he's doing around here as helping with all these repairs if he's going to get ready in the morning to do his job and walks around with only his hat on? Right? I mean, it might be a little embarrassing for Gus, but most of us would say, what's he doing with just his hat on? And yet it seems that most of the time, the kind of theology that we preach, the kind of theology we proclaim, it basically equips people or encourages people to put on their hats without the rest of their clothing. I think, again, the situation within Latin America and other countries of the two-thirds world that emphasize perhaps more the free for emphasis, which is where we would get all the political sides of how one lives and works within society, right? They're encouraging us to be more fully dressed. Of course you put on your hat, but also remember to put on your shirt and your slacks and your shoes and your belt, because if you're going to go out there and work in the world, you have to be fully dressed, right? A hat isn't enough. And so I think that, again, in Latin America, they take that kind of understanding seriously, so that holiness, right, the way of being in the world as a Christian, our orientation, what makes us distinct in the life of faith, always works together with politics. The way in which we structure and order our society for the common good of all people, for the working of justice, for the preservation of peace, for the humanization of people, right? Again, to think about this, right? God's redemption of the world is not to destroy creation and people within creation, but to enable that creation to live fully, completely, in terms of God's peace, God's shalom, God's wholeness, God's life. Right. And again, I can't help but refer you to Christine Carlson's Bible study this morning when she, Romans 8 in creation, talks all about that. I was going to talk about that here for a while tonight, but she did such a good job this morning. Just listen to her tape and it'll be covered. But that's that sense, right? That God is at work redeeming the creation, and so now Christians are co-creators, co-workers with God, co-laborers, right? That was Christine's key word this morning, in all of that. And I think here again, the people of Central America and the churches in Central America, I think, have understood that better than we have in Western Europe and in North America. And this is something that we can learn from them. This is something that they can help us understand. Now, why have we been sidetracked? Maybe to ask that kind of question. I will be very bold and put forward two answers. And probably there can be a lot of disagreement by this, but two answers. One, a more theological answer, and the other one, a more political kind of answer. First of all, the theological answer as to why we've been sidetracked by all of this is that I think in the West, for about the past 200 years, we've been asking the wrong question. And so, of course, if you ask the wrong question, you probably won't get the right answer anyway. And the question we've been so bent on asking is this one. Does God exist? Or another way of phrasing it is, what good is God? Those are for me at least, those are two ways of saying the same thing, right? Philosophically, since the Enlightenment and the move towards secularism and all of that, that's the kind of question, right? Does God exist? And right, in university, if you take an introduction to philosophy class or maybe even an introduction to religion class, you'll work through all those kinds of arguments about proofs for the existence of God and all of that. Or the kind of thing, what good is God? That's the kind of question that has been asked by folks that are called the masters of suspicion. Folks that are suspicious, right? They ask these kind of questions. In the West, the key masters of suspicion have been people like Karl Marx, who says, well, you know, religion, and particularly Christianity, what good is it, and what good is that God? Well, it functions as an opiate of the people. That religion is used by the political powers to kind of lull people out of their pain and suffering and make them live with deplorable conditions and say it's okay because it gives them pie in the sky by and by. Right, so we can then all sing, I'm but a stranger here, heaven is my home. And so it doesn't make any difference what people do to you here because that's not important. Right, so religion is that kind of opiate, says Karl Marx. Or, again, the philosopher Ludwig Feuerbach says that religion and talk about God is simply a human projection. It's just something that we, in terms of human beings, as our own ideals, our own goals, whatever we think is the most important thing in life, we make that up and we project it up there into the heavens and call it God, because it legitimates the way we live and work in the world. So it's just a projection, that's what it is. Or someone like Friedrich Nietzsche. Says, what good is God and what good is Christianity? It's a herd morality. In other words, it's kind of the religion of whiners. So that we can use religion and we can use God to kind of make other people feel guilty so we can get what we want, right? So that when something doesn't happen, right, we can say, oh, but does God like that? Or God is going to get you, or behave, you know. And of course, you know, Nietzsche being a German and working with other Nordic folks, he figures, you know, whether you're Scandinavian or German, Teutonic, we all have this great guilt that we love to carry with us. So he says, doesn't Christianity fit into that? What better way to make people feel guilty than to come around with all this God stuff and make them feel guilty? The one last master of suspicion here in the West is Freud. And Jim Boyer has talked about this as well in his classes. But religion is just one of the manifestations of our neuroses, and we use it to repress our libidinal urges and, you know, kind of keep our id in line and all of that, so we become kind of neurotic, semi-adjusted people, right? So does God exist? Well, not really. I mean, we just kind of make up this concept of God, you know, to get what we want out of other people and other what? So, you know, what good is God? Well, God is this kind of crutch or club or legitimator that human beings make up to have the kind of power relationships they want in society. That's kind of what our secular culture has been telling us about God. Christianity then within that culture has always tried to answer these masters of suspicion and say, no, no, that's not right. God is not the opiate. Religion is not an opiate. God is not a projection. It's not just a guilt trip and so on and so forth. And so we've been engaged in that so that the task of Christianity in all of this has been an apologetic task. Now again, that's a technical term, meaning not the Christian theologians going around to all these people saying, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. It's not, it's from the Greek apologia, which means defend. So that by and large, what Christianity has been doing, and certainly what most theologians have been doing in the West for the past 200 years, is defending Christianity against all these kinds of suspicions and attacks, and saying, you've got it wrong, and here's really what Christianity is all about. Now, the two-thirds world, and again, particularly theologians of liberation, say, this is the wrong question. That this might be a nice little exercise when basically you live in an affluent society and everything is nice, but forget this question. Forget this marker, too. Let's try another one. Right? Forget this question. And rather than asking, does God exist, or what good is God, what we have to ask is the question, who is your God? Or maybe this might be a what. What or who is your God? And a question similar to this would be, for whose good is God? Note the shift there. The first thing that these folks do in this question, right? What or who is your God? Is already the admission that we all have gods. It may not be the Christian God. It might be the political power of the state. It might be money. It might be something as personal as your own honor and reputation. Whatever. We all have gods, but the first question is first to figure out, right, who or what is your God? And then, right, from the Christian perspective, right, the notion there is that God will either be an idol or indeed it's the true God. And the second question then is, for whose good is God? And here again, from their reading of Scripture, they say that what? Because God is the God of life, for whose good is God? God is good for all people, but what they want to note is that God is especially there and caring for the poor. Now, the poor is a category that does not mean simply those who are in poverty, although poverty is often part of what it means to be poor. But that understanding of the poor entails those for whom no one else seems to care. Those who are marginalized, those who are shunted away, those that everyone in society subjugates and puts down. And as these theologians within the two-thirds world, and again here I want to talk specifically about Central America, as they read the scriptures, they find out, isn't it surprising that as one reads the Bible, we see an unprecedented preference that God always talks so much and is so concerned about the poor? It's not that God doesn't care for the other people, but we see that God always says that if you really don't care for the poor, you are not following through on what faithful living with me is all about, because I care for the poor. An example. They point to the Exodus. Now they could say, when the Exodus comes along, right, God has a choice.
Right.
For whom does God want to be God? For whom does God want to be good? The powerful pyramid-building Egyptians? Those low-down, mud-stomping Hebrew slaves. God chooses the mud-stomping Hebrew slaves. Why? God doesn't have to. God isn't bound to that. But yet God chooses those who are poor and downtrodden. Right? That God hears their sufferings, their cries of affliction, and says, I will come to deliver them. Or the reading of the New Testament, and particularly the Gospels, and they say, look at Jesus. Right? Again, with whom does Jesus spend most of his time? For whom does Jesus show particular care and concern? Those whom everyone else in society has thrown out, has disregarded, has tossed out as saying that either religiously they are unclean or politically they are subversive and traitorous and you shouldn't mess with them, or morally they are unfit and indecent. And those are the folks that Jesus hangs around and says to them, good news for you. God's grace is also for you. God, who is a God of life and forgiveness and peace and wholeness, is also for you. And it gets him into a lot of trouble. The religious authorities don't like that. The political authorities don't like that. Because, right, the bottom line is, they don't have that God as their God. Who is their God? Their own human traditions. Whether that be their religious traditions or whether that be the power of the state, Rome and its eagle that spreads its wings over all the earth. Right? And compared to that majestic Roman eagle, Jesus talks about himself and God as what? That chicken, right? That mother hen, hardly as magnificent a bird as an eagle, right? But that caring, loving mother hen who would indeed tuck all of her chicks under her wing. Right? Again, right? Whose side do you want to be on? The eagles are the chickens, right? And here again, the thing is, well, God's on the chicken's side, right? All of those metaphors there express that kind of understanding that God is intimately involved, cares for, and is concerned about the life of the poor. So that's one reason I think that we in North America have gotten things wrong. We've been asking the wrong question and pursuing the wrong question. If we would be asking these kinds of questions, and I think we're starting to get around to that, our answers and our theology and even the way we understand our role as Christians in church and in the world would be changing. Right. That's the first kind of explanation for this, the more theological one. The second explanation, a more political one, but again, I think has significant theological ways of talking about too. And if you've been attending some of the things that Roland has been talking about he's gone into this in far greater detail than I have. By and large, the way the power structures in our world are built today and the way we operate is that we are lovers of death and violence. The reason I want to say that that's also theological is that, remember, right, we as Christians proclaim a God of life. But I think most of the politics that happens in our world today is a politics of violence and shows us to be lovers of death. Right? Think about it. I mean, what won't we kill to maintain our standard of living? Right? What won't we kill to maintain our standard of living? One of the things that comes out so clearly and is so difficult for folks to deal with, and rightly so, I mean, for people from Canada and the United States that go down with me to Central America on these seminars, are just taken aback at the devastation in those countries because of what First World nations, and particularly the United States, has done to these countries and to these people in order to maintain their standard of living, or I should say, our standard of living and our way of life. We have no qualms about starving people to death, killing people, training and instructing armies in the finest methods of torture known, right? I mean, again, the brutalities that Central American militaries learn, they learned from United States military intelligence and the CIA. We taught them all those great rules of repression, because we are willing to stop at nothing in order to maintain the United States' sphere of influence in this region of the world, and certainly on the broader level, that again, the developed countries, it seems, are willing to stop at nothing in order to maintain their, particularly their economic superiority over the peoples of this world. And it's devastating, right? And it's the kind of thing to say from the distance, oh no, it can't be true, and so on and so forth. But the thing is, when coming face to face with, right, children that are diseased from dysentery and everything that just shouldn't happen, the distended bellies, the malnutrition, the starvation, right, the wounded people, the infliction of torture, the mass graves, they're all there. Just go have a look. Who did it? We are lovers of death. Pablo Richard, one liberation theologian down there, says that really, if you want to talk about what most of the developed countries are about, he says, they are really necrophiliacs, right? I mean, making love with dead corpses. That's what they do. He says, because indeed, that's what they are doing to us. They literally want to turn our people and our country into a corpse, because that's something they can make love to. I mean, it's a grotesque image, but he wants that image to be there. He does not want you to be comfortable. Right? As abrasive and disgusting as that may sound, he does not want you to be comfortable. And properly so, right? I mean, he has seen too many people die so that folks in the United States can have cheap bananas. Right. For example, in Guatemala,
Is the fact that we have cheap bananas worth 80,000 people killed, 45,000 people disappeared, 1.5 million people in exile and displaced, just so we can have cheap bananas? Right? That's the political realities of international politics and what's happening to the people of Guatemala. I mean, I can talk about examples in Nicaragua in terms of, think about what has happened in that country because of the United States, in particular, again, sponsoring the Contras and that low-intensity warfare, which was purposefully targeted, again, at killing health workers, teachers, nurses, doctors, catechists, priests, bombing and blowing up schools, hospitals, power lines, dams, to ruin the entire infrastructure of a country and to make sure that its organizers and leaders and those kinds of people wouldn't be around, so that the country literally would fall into chaos. That's the goal of low-intensity warfare. That's what the United States was about in Nicaragua, right? Lovers of death. And again, right, into this kind of arena comes this notion of liberation theology, that God is a God of life, and obviously, right, because of this statement, the kind of politics one espouses is going to be clean contrary to this notion of people and ways that indeed are lovers of death and violence. There is something else that must happen. Those that engage in this practice and those who espouse this practice must be resisted, must be spoken against. There, if you will, is their prophetic word of denunciation, to say that to do this is not God's will. This kind of dehumanization, this kind of love of death, this kind of subjugation and oppression is not what God, as creator and redeemer, wills for this creation and for all human beings. And we will continue to speak out against that and oppose it, because that's who we are as Christians. Right? And their call, if you will, to us is join us. Right? It's more than, let's say, a denunciation. It's a call to Christians in the first world, in North America, in the United States, to say, join with us. Proclaim with us that God who is a God of life. And that also means then join with us in denouncing all those who have other gods, who engage in the idolatries of power and violence and greed and are lovers of death. Right? At that point, they say it's a very significant and they think clear-cut choice. Right? Are you on the side of the God of life, or do you too wish to join all those others who are lovers of death? Are you too one of the necrophiliacs? That's kind of the open-ended question they pose, and to say, it's up to you, Christians of North America. How do you decide? How do you understand? How do you interpret? Anyway, enough from me. We have about 15 minutes or so. I'd like to just kind of
open it up for discussion, questions, reaction. I know some of this stuff is not easy to hear, I can appreciate that. But I also, quite frankly, do want to be pretty blunt about this and confront you with that, because this is the reality of Central America. And we have to work with that. That is the reality. How will we as Christians respond? Please.
There seems to be a common distortion of the gospel in that for many people there's an identification of prosperity as being identified as showing that God is with us or God has blessed us. Mm-hmm. Has that been present from the beginning of Christianity? Has that always been a justification for wealth, or is that something?
No. That notion of prosperity as a sign that God is with us is something that developed after the Reformation within Calvinism, followers of John Calvin. Not Calvin himself, but followers of Calvin, like the Puritans, who settled New England in the U.S. and that, and the way that snuck in was through another kind of bad theology called double predestination. Now Calvin did believe in double predestination. Luther did not, for example. Just to note the kind of two key figures of the Reformation, one of their significant differences. Now, what double predestination is all about, in terms of the way Calvin presents it, is that from before eternity, God predestined some to salvation and some to damnation. Right, that's why it's double predestination. It's kind of like almost as if before eternity, God had a roll call of all the people in the world and went through and went, save, save, damn, damn, save, damn, save, damn, 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 save, 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 save. Right. That's, a bit of a caricature, but quite frankly, that's what double predestination would entail. Right. Now, given that case, right, the Puritans worked on that and to say, okay, now, right, how do I know, because I'm a Puritan now, how do I know whether I have been elected by God from eternity to be saved, or whether I was elected by God from eternity to be damned? Certainly God wouldn't be so cruel as to not give me any clues, so what are the clues? And in their reading and interpretation of Scripture, the clues for that are basically that those who have prosperity, good health, children, all of those kinds of blessings from God must be the saved. Because after all, and again here kind of that Puritan frugality comes in as well, it wouldn't make much sense for God to waste all of those divine blessings on people who are going to be eternally damned anyway, right? I mean, that's just not very logical. So it would make perfect sense that basically God showers blessings upon those whom God has elected to salvation. So it's with that kind of theology and that kind of ethic that today has kind of evolved into what we call at times that gospel of health and wealth, and that if you do what God says and behave accordingly and so on and so forth, then you're saved. And in that sense, it's terrible theology. It's certainly not biblical theology. I mean, because if that were the case, you would have to say, my goodness, then what happened to Jesus? Right? Jesus, the guy who couldn't hold a job, he was basically always unemployed. Jesus, the guy that never made any money. Right?
Jesus, the guy who certainly didn't have any political power or clout or honor, Jesus, the guy who dies on the cross, hardly the clues that one would say, you are saved by God. And yet Christians say, but this Jesus, precisely because of all of that, is also the one who we call the Messiah, the Christ, the Son of God, the one who saves us all. I mean, at that point you say, there's something a little screwy there with that gospel of health and wealth and that God only blesses those who are saved because, right? Again, from the scriptures it seems God is certainly working salvifically among the poor, just as much as God is working among the rich. Gesundheit.
Danke. We have some of this in our Lutheran church now, too. It seems to me the Lutheran church is kind of an upper-class church. And when you think of Salvation Army, then you think of our Lutheran church.
Mm-hmm. Or certainly we're middle-class. Maybe not upper class, but we're certainly firmly within the middle class, yes. Yeah. And I know that there are, I mean, think about this again in terms of the indictment among Lutheran churches that are in changing neighborhoods. Right? And the struggle those churches go through in terms of what? Do we move out to the suburbs or do we stay where we're at and minister to those people who are there? Because they too are truly loved by God and God is for them, right? And now knowing how we are freed from sin, death, the devil, and all our egocentrisms, right? We should be free for ministry to that place. But very often, right, it's very difficult for churches in changing neighborhoods to change their ministry and right, kind of hang in there and stay with it. I mean, again, the kind of thing in whatever congregation you are and wherever you might be living, that kind of, right, think about who are the people next to you in the pew, and even there, who are the people that your congregation would consider to be desirable church members? Right? And usually the desirable ones are what? People who are just like us. And that puts us in the same kind of, right, social class, economic class, often racially, and so on and so forth. Those others out there, right? Problems. Don't rock the boat. We don't want those in our church. It would make ministry too difficult.
With Christians being a minority in the United States, and those of us that call ourselves Christians and not concerned about the real situation, how does this political situation change?
I think that for us as Christians, how to change the political situation is twofold, right? Two things that I would suggest right away. The first thing is, through being a good citizen, we do have a vote. Right? And I know sometimes it feels that there's not much choice. But we do have a vote, and we do have the power of lobbying and influencing people in Congress and elsewhere. I think we just simply need to exercise that.
But we're a minority, and then when you take the minority and then sift out the political.
Yes, but very often, right? Very often, as you well know, a vocal minority has a tremendous amount of influence.
your congressperson probably wouldn't like 50 people from his or her district harping at him all the time to change this or that, or if not, right, you will work as hard as possible to make sure he, she is not elected this fall. Chances are you will get that person's ear. Right. I mean, obviously, I'm not trying to be utopian and idealistic to say you can change everything. And I know there are other forces out there far more powerful than simply what we might be. But on the other hand, to do nothing means the status quo continues.
The majority of us don't know the situation.
No, that's right. And that means the first thing to do is to get informed. Right? That's the ones. I mean, again, that part of being informed, active citizens. That's one thing I think we can do. I think the second thing we can do in terms of our particular congregations and where we're at is, again, to say, who are the poor? Where are the poor in our community? And where is our outreach to them? How do we begin that outreach? Again, the kind of thing that in the United States and Canada, we can, because of our society and the way it's constructed, we can do a pretty good job of hiding the poor and hiding poverty. But it's out there. Or ignoring it. Right. And again, there I think the first task of who we are, again, as people of God in our particular congregations, is to simply ask, who are the poor in our communities, right? Stop ignoring them, finding out where they are, and then, right, what would be some appropriate forms of ministry, of outreach? Where is it that we, again, as followers of Christ, are free for, right, loving them, caring for them, working with them, so that they too can have that abundant life that is promised us by God? Right? That's something that happens in our local situations. Don Brandt also in his session again is talking, right? Our churches need to be more involved in outreach. And part of that is simply outreach to our communities. And then again, it takes all sorts of different forms depending on where your community happens to be. But my hunch is there certainly are people there who are suffering from injustice, marginalization, poverty, racism, right, of something. I don't know of the perfect community. Right? If you do, let me know. I would just like to note that place. Right. I mean, there is work for us as Christians wherever we find ourselves, wherever we are.
Seems to me that in our Lutheran Church, and it's been kind of alluded to already, but many of these folks that are marginal, if we want to use that term, say, financially, politically, they wouldn't feel comfortable in our church. That is our fault, I understand. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you correct, I don't know how that goes about. You have a traditional church, you have a congregation that, as you mentioned, they're similar to us. And to assimilate the ones that aren't like us.
We do nice things. Like having a supper once a week where the homeless can come in. But that's not really accepting those homeless people. We're doing something, but we're not really including them in our life.
Right. It's a short-term kind of measure, but it isn't, again, changing the structures that make the homeless homeless, or indeed incorporating them within a kind of change. I think the other thing, and Gus, that's a good point. I mean, even there, our thinking has to change sometimes in terms of not always, first of all, thinking, now how are we going to bring all those people into our church? I think our thinking has to be reversed and to say, how are we going to get our church to go out there and be with all those people? Right. I mean, think about the Gospels again, and particularly when Jesus sends out the 70 and what Jesus commands those 70 to do. If you will, Jesus, I always kind of look at it as Jesus' evangelism program is basically the opposite of what we do. Most of our evangelism programs are trying to figure out how to bring all those people out there into our church. Jesus wasn't concerned about how those 70 were going to bring all those people to him at Capernaum or Nazareth or wherever he happened to be. His concern was to figure how he could get those 70 out there to what? To be spreading the good news, to engage in healing, to proclaim that God's reign and rule of grace was among all people. So Jesus was always trying to figure out, how can I get those who are following me out there in the world ministering and spreading that good news? Not how do we get them all into our church?
Yeah.